Good afternoon. Today is April 27, 2017. We will open a subcommittee on public safety and also open an informational meeting on juvenile dependency representation. And so if Mr. Bender will give us a overview and then we'll start inviting people up.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and subcommittee members. In the 2015 session, the legislature passed Senate Bill 222. One of the provisions of that bill was to extend a temporary provision that allows DHS, the Department of Human Services, child welfare caseworkers to appear in juvenile court dependency proceedings without the presence of an attorney. In that bill, that particular practice was the permissibility of that practice was extended to June 30th, 2018. So it's extended for 1 year of this upcoming biennium. Also in that bill, the legislature established the Task Force on Legal Representation and Childhood Dependency and charged this task force with reviewing issues related to legal representation in these cases and how the process could be improved and outcomes could be improved in childhood dependency cases. Today, on your schedule, you will first be hearing a report basically summarizing the task force's work from Debbie Kretzky in the governor's office and Justice David Brewer, who was the chair of the task force. Then after that, we have a number of agencies who are affected by recommendations that were in that report. They'll be coming forward to talk to you about what those recommendations were and how much they would cost to implement. Some of these budgets are not actually in your purview. They're in other Ways and Means subcommittees. But in order to get a complete picture, we've asked all of the agencies that we could identify that would have budget adjustments to implement the task force to come forward to you today.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Minnery. And just to add, for if you have not heard from myself, from Senator Winters on this topic, because we had a lot of people say, well, what is it you're actually trying to accomplish on this day? And because there are several pieces of legislation out there related to that may or may not be the exact of what the task force put forward, a lot of things out there related. And the goal of today is really to try to get, in the spirit of our gambling bill earlier today that we debated for way too long, get all the chips on the table. So as we go into the latter part of this session, that we actually have really talked through all the different things. In addition, we have had a similar presentation already presented in the House. It was in House Judiciary some time back. This presentation, I've asked for it to be a little bit different and be more directed toward the fiscal portion and the budget portion of that. So if you want more information or think there's something that we might have gone into deeper, we can get you to ask us and we can get you the dates on when that hearing was, and you can go back and watch that. On that note, we will invite up Justice Brewer and Debbie Kretzky, whichever order you choose to open up.
Hi, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Debbie Kretzky, and I am the Senior Director for Budget and Children's Policy for Oregon's Governor Kate Brown. My role today is to let you know that you'll hear from all the parties that participated in the interim task force appointed by the governor, which was created out of Senate Bill 222. There were 18 members of the task force, four of which were from the legislature. The judicial branch was represented, and also the executive branch. And I think that this is probably one of those stories of success where you will hear from all three branches of government saying, we worked together, we recognized a need, and we're coming back to report to the legislature about what that need was and why the importance of it. I accepted my position and started on January 3rd, and I think I have a lot of gratitude for several people in the room and hopefully some that are listening either through the internet or on TV. And Addie Smith was the governor's staff person who staffed this interim work task force, and she did very good work, and it's if you look on OLIS, you can see the result of that, the report issued from the task force. Justice Brewer sitting next to me spent many hours chairing that. Representative Stark served on that committee, so thank you all very much for your service. Thank you for all the the people from the department that worked on this. The policy option package that's part of that came from the task force. There were several. Those include better representation for parents and children, better representation for the department, improvements at CASA, Justice Brewer. I'm missing some, but Justice Brewer will tick through them in a much more articulate fashion than I could. The main purpose that I wanted to share with you was why this is so important to the governor, the governor recommended several different policy option packages to help improve the Child Welfare Department at the Department of Human Services. That includes more caseworkers, better training. I'm missing some, and Clyde Psyche, I'm sure, will better reimbursements for foster parents, and then also better reimbursements for BRS service providers, and we also consider this important. This policy option package, the policy option package that improves representation for the department, and then also hopefully the recommendations for parent and children's attorneys, is probably the governor's top priority out of these policy option packages. And the reason why, and I'm actually thankful for the Marion County DA's office for letting me see these proceedings firsthand, is when you go to proceedings, and I know Representative Stark has been a party to these, when you go to the proceedings and the attorneys are not prepared for court, when they flipped over, what happens to children who are in care is that they stay longer. The attorneys are a very, very vital part. And as you witness the proceedings, you can see the attorneys that have been part of families who have been on cases a very long time, who know the attorneys from the other parties. And you can see those proceedings go like this when you go and watch. Because the attorneys come in, they're prepared, they know the families, they know the kids that are involved, they understand the circumstances, they're ready to go to make decisions. They come in, the judge asks questions, and you can see that, and you can say, okay, we're coming back on Thursday, here's what I want, everybody nods their head, boom, 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 and you kind of feel like, okay, this is going where it is. And then you go to another proceeding where that doesn't happen, questions are being asked, and you know the outcome from that child is going to be delayed, that they're going to stay in care, whether or not that's the best decision, because people, they just don't have their stuff together. So the attorneys play a very, very, very vital role in what happens to the children that come into care in Oregon. So that's why we are here. That is the framework for that. I know, as I've met with very many members of the legislature, that it's a harder concept to grasp, you know, about why this becomes a top priority to improve outcomes for these children. But it really does make a difference, and it's very vitally important. So thank you.
Co-chairs Winters and Stark, and members of the committee. My name is Dave Brewer. I'm a judge on the Oregon Supreme Court, and I had the privilege of chairing the task force that you put together with legislation in the last session, and am here today to provide an overview of what the charge of the task force was, what the recommendations were, to set the table for what Mr. Bender described, the details, the guts of the various proposals and budget impacts from the rest of the stakeholders. So if you'll indulge me for a bit, I'd like to take a few minutes and really sort of take that trip for you one more time so that we have the table properly set. I want to thank you, first of all, for providing the staff and the other resources, as Debbie said, to engage in a first-time thorough assessment of Oregon's current dependency representation practices and the opportunity to provide some comprehensive recommendations for our most vulnerable children and families. And it was an honor to chair the task force, to work with the governor and her representatives, members of this body, and so many committed professionals across the state who tirelessly provide help to children and families with the greatest needs. And as Debbie mentioned, particular Senators Cruz and Przanski, Representative Stark, the co-chair here, and then Representative now Senator Taylor, were dedicated members of the task force and participated with great care and concern. As you all know, the judicial dependency system supports and oversees the larger child welfare system here in Oregon. And it's the system that protects the legal rights of Oregon's parents, promotes sound decisions and good outcomes for Oregon's children, and ensures that the Child Welfare Agency, the Department of Human Services, is accountable to compliance with the laws and policy that govern its work. So a strong dependency system, I think it goes without saying, is key to a strong, well-functioning child welfare system. And that's why the work of this task force could not have been timelier, and why I think our findings really, if you think about them, are far from surprising. I'll start with a little bit of statistics from a 2016 workload study done for the Oregon Judicial Department. And I believe Mr. Bender has been provided with the backup for the data I'm about to share. And Leola McKenzie can do that for you, Mr. Bender, if you don't have it yet, so you can provide it to the committee. But on average, what that workload study shows is that juvenile dependency cases use more judicial resources than any other case types before our trial courts. These cases are very complex. They also involve many hearings that sometimes run the risk of spilling over on top of each other. There have been many changes from state and federal law that impact the work of juvenile judges, practitioners, and caseworkers. We provided a table to Mr. Bender that shows the number of changes that directly impact the work of all of these folks between 2001 and 2016. 36 changes at all, in all statutory changes, with 28 that are specific to dependency cases, and that doesn't include the many appellate court decisions that construe these statutes and that from time to time alter the way practice must occur in the juvenile courts in order to comply with the law. So as a part of the table setting here, I think it's important to understand that this is not kiddie court. This work requires specialization. It requires considerable expertise. When I first graduated from law school, some people pejoratively referred to juvenile court as kiddie court, if you can imagine that. Believe me, the landscape has changed, and we get the difference, and we're determined to treat it with top priority in our cases, both by law and by our internal practices. So with that background, for a period of 15 months in 2015 and 16, our task force, which consisted of 18 members from all three branches of government, all parties in the dependency process, and local and national experts that were brought to bear, we gathered information on our child welfare system, our current models of dependency representation, promising local practices that we looked at, and national best practices as established by respected agencies and courts in other states. The task force held 10 full task force meetings with opportunities to observe court in a number of counties. We had meetings with practitioners. We supported 5 subcommittee processes and engaged in many informal stakeholder outreach meetings. We spent time in Multnomah, Lynn, Jackson, and Marion counties with the courts, with the practitioners, with the caseworkers, and offered opportunities for public comment, and we received that at each of those meetings. We did our best to ensure both a robust and a fair process governed this task force, and we welcomed and personally sought input from a wide range of stakeholders without preconceived notions of how anything should come out. And we encouraged the task force, whenever possible, to ask tough questions, both of the system and of ourselves. Ultimately, the strength of the recommendations derives from the effects of efforts of child welfare champions from all three branches of government. We were galvanized by 2 common goals: one, protecting the legal rights of families, and improving, and the second was improving outcomes for our most vulnerable children. Both of those things paramount. These objectives spurred the task force to take a fresh, hard look at the efficacy of our current models, to think beyond the status quo and put families and children first. And so here's what we found, and I'll start with our first recommendation. This is about government representation. Oregon's current system for government representation in dependency cases is a clear national outlier. The current model of government representation is a hybrid model, where the Department of Justice represents the agency at the termination of parental rights stage, but district attorneys represent the state of Oregon at the jurisdictional stage in roughly 2/3 of the counties in the state. You might think that the state of Oregon and DHS are the same entity. A lot of people do. They are not. DAs do not have an attorney-client relationship with DHS. They represent the broader entity, the state of Oregon, by statute. As the sole exception, the Multnomah County DA has an intergovernmental agreement, an IGA, to litigate TPR trials in Multnomah County. In the majority of counties, the DAs do not attend shelter hearings. Those are the first hearing held after a child is removed and placed in substitute care. It's an important hearing in the dependency process. And in about two-thirds of the counties, the DAs write or review dependency petitions that are filed by the caseworkers. In other counties, they don't do that. So to put it bluntly, because they don't have an attorney-client relationship with DAs, except in Multnomah County, DHS caseworkers are consistently, unlawfully practicing law under the current model. That practice is something that we cannot ignore in a system of responsible government. It leaves the agency open to liability and constant legal risk. Not only that, it is inefficient, costly, and creates inconsistent practice across the state. Among other problems, although parent and child practitioners have performance standards that have been adopted in cooperation with the Oregon State Bar, so far, government attorneys in Oregon do not have corresponding standards guiding their practice on a statewide basis. So the task force, in light of this condition, reviewed models of representation used across the country. We surveyed academic literature, and we investigated the recommendations of national standard-setting agencies to identify the attributes of quality systems of government representation. Four of those attributes are critical to the improvement of our dependency representation model for the government. The first is availability. Those priorities show that attorneys must have sufficient time and ability to meet the needs of DHS and the court. When attorneys are readily available, it's easier for case managers to seek input from legal counsel, make collective, sound decisions about child welfare cases, and schedule court hearings in a timely manner. Attorney availability guides the lawful practice in and outside court and promotes better DHS decision-making, case resolution, and decreases the risk of liability. The second priority is consistency. Oregon families need to receive consistent, standards-based, competent legal representation, which requires quality assurance and accountability to the rule of law in this state. Third is cost-effective and cost-efficient service, and that ensures that funds are spent to support necessary value-added services that protect the agency and promote lawful practice. These services also ensure that legal services are provided in a way that takes advantage of available economies of scale, process efficiencies, and technology advances, in addition to decreasing unnecessary transaction costs. These attributes collectively ensure that quality legal services are provided without excessive cost. And fourth, the service must be outcome-oriented. We must remember that what we're trying to do is to improve at all times outcomes for children and families. The rest is process. Good, consistent process produces the best results in the large view, and that's absolutely critical where resources are short. So stakeholders must not only do their utmost to fulfill their distinct roles, but they have to work collectively, where legally possible and feasible, towards the common goal of improving outcomes for children and families. It's different than the regular adversary system that you see in civil cases and criminal cases. Our role here is to work together, even though we have different responsibilities within that system. It's fundamentally different. If you take a look at the discussion in the task force report, and I hope you'll find the time to do that, because folks worked pretty hard to communicate this information back to you, you'll see that the American Bar Association, which is the national leading expert association in this area, specifically recommends against the use of a hybrid model of representation like Oregon's because of the inherent risks of conflict that it creates for attorneys. Instead, the ABA recommends a single entity representation model. This is consistent with the assessments and scholarly reviews of agency representation that have been completed in the last two decades. Of note is the only empirical study completed on government agency models. It was done in 2003, and it compared two models for representing the government. In one, assistant district attorneys represented the state, and in the other model, project attorneys, like DOJ, were employed to represent the agency. The study found that when those project attorneys represented the agency, there were consistently more focused court hearings and the court workers were better prepared for the hearings. This is a significant finding because other studies find that a higher frequency of judicial involvement is a key indicator and predictor of quicker case resolution. Judges need to actively manage cases. To do that effectively, they need lawyers to help them prepare and communicate and make sure everything runs on time and in the right way and that all the necessary information is provided in the court. The results also showed that caseworkers overwhelmingly preferred the agency attorney model over the prosecutorial model because they developed better long-term relationships with the attorneys, received more help and guidance as they managed the cases. All studies of successful models for government representation described by these standard-setting agencies and seen nationwide highlight the importance of consistent, continuous, and comprehensive legal representation for the government. The ABA standards require government attorneys to protect and promote the agency's credibility, advise and counsel on all legal matters, prepare or review the initial petition, which is a legal document in the case, and promote timely hearings and avoid unnecessary delays. Also to review court orders to make sure they're consistent with what the court actually ordered in open court. You'd be amazed how often there can be a slip in that regard, and you've got to go back and fix it. And in the meantime, there's no lawful order that does exactly what the court said needed to be done. So all the states that the task force staff interviewed, and we, Addie Smith, whom you heard Debbie refer to, interviewed experts in many states about their models and processes, described consistent and comprehensive systems of representation as meaning that one entity represented the agency in the majority of cases. Most attorneys carry cases from start to finish, and attorneys provide advice and counsel on all legal matters. And in these interviews, it was also found that all the states had open door policies where case managers are encouraged to reach out to attorneys at any time and for any reason to make sure the case doesn't go off the rails. Each state reported that this practice promoted lawful case decisions, saved the agency and the attorneys substantial time and money by preventing unnecessary mistakes and improving case decisions. In contrast, the variance in practices, staffing, and budgets in Oregon's hybrid model makes it almost impossible to determine what an average caseload is. Data collected, though, shows that attorneys in our system are likely managing well above the ABA's recommendation of 60 to 80 cases at any given time, understanding that these cases are of relatively short duration. In terms of our overall recommendation, the task force overwhelmingly agreed that the current model doesn't satisfy any of the priority criteria for a functional dependency system. We looked hard at three possible single representation models: DOJ agency representation, a statewide prosecutorial model, and in-house representation for the agency. The only one that made any sense to us, although not perfect, was the DOJ model with a block grant requirement. It is simply not politically, practically, or otherwise realistic for the elected DAs to represent the agency in every county in the state. And in our study of in-house models, there is always a risk of counsel becoming captive to the agency culture, rather than having the creative tension of having agency outside representation, which is both independent and at the same time steeped in a commitment to the agency as a client. That creative tension is critical in any attorney-client relationship. Now, I understand that you naturally have global concerns about dependency system reform. So do we. But this is a digestible, discreet, and intelligent foundational piece of the reform we all want to see that's both achievable now and puts children and families first by promoting consistent and timely outcomes, not a patchwork quilt that contributes to balkanized practices and less certain outcomes. Turning to our second charge and findings, which was to study the representation of children and parents in the dependency system. The task force found that Oregon's current system for parent and child representation is not meeting the needs of Oregon families. With the exception of three counties, an antiquated payment system, and a history of underfunding, have forced parent and child attorneys to take on high caseloads where they are constantly triaging case management and emergencies and appearing in court sometimes in a way that prevents them from working on their cases with their clients proactively. In three counties in Oregon, this is not the case, where the parent and child representation program, a recognized national state best practice, has been introduced. Those counties are Linn, Yamhill, and Columbia. And in those three counties, attorneys are paid based on a workload model with caseload caps. In those counties, parent and child attorneys are able to spend the time necessary to prepare for court, work with clients, and avoid unnecessary case emergencies, which always reduce efficiency. We also found that Oregon lacks, in addition to the issue with parent and child attorneys, a coordinated quality assurance process to track dependency data. Again, good data produces good practice. And we need a feedback loop for practitioners to look at data hard, figure out how to best allocate our resources. So in light of these findings and after assessing the alternative models of representation the task force has made, these recommendations, and we think if they're implemented, it will dramatically improve outcomes for children and families. First, that the agency have full representation from petition to permanency in child welfare cases. In the current system, DHS is the only party in a juvenile case not consistently represented by counsel. The agency charged with making the most important safety and permanency decisions that affect the lives of children and families, sometimes forever, should have consistent advice and legal counsel at every hearing, like all other parties. Representation should include attorney presence in the courtroom and regular access to and oversight from legal counsel throughout the life of a case. In addition to helping prevent the unlawful practice of law by DHS employees, legal counsel that extends beyond the courtroom can help change the culture of DHS by consistently promoting quality casework that's in line with our laws. Second, to ensure that representation, the task force recommends that the Department of Justice, the entity in Oregon that is statutorily required to represent DHS, must negotiate a flat fee billing model and staff cases according to a workload model with a case cap. Dependency cases are like no other cases handled by DOJ. They bring practitioners into court on a daily basis. They require regular and consistent contact and oversight of the agency. And the client literally includes hundreds of different employees who need direct access to DOJ advice regularly. Because of the unique nature of this work, a unique billing model is required. DOJ has been working with the Oregon State Bar to put in place performance standards to guide consistent, rigorous practice, quality practice statewide. Next, in Oregon, the district attorneys perform an important role. They represent an entity unique from the agency, the state, or the people. It's unique. Nothing in this recommendation is intended to prevent them from continuing this role. That being said, the task force understands that there are state budget limitations that are very serious. So we have recommended that the funding provided to DHS for legal counsel be used for legal counsel that represents DHS, not something else. Next, the task force represents that funding be provided to roll out the parent and child representation program, and that's the workload model that includes case caps to all counties in the state. And this practice, which was adopted based on the work of our sister state, Washington, provides attorneys with the time they need to better engage clients and manage their cases. It's already begun to produce good results and improve outcomes in our three pilot counties. Finally, we've recommended that specific output and quality outcome measures should be collected and reported, and that a continuous quality improvement system, not just because it ain't broke, we don't fix it, we're constantly trying to improve the system, should be formed and led by the Judicial Department. This team should monitor, we believe, the efficiency of the dependency system and provide the legislature, practitioners, and other stakeholders with the information necessary to improve the system. The Judicial Department was identified as best suited to provide ongoing leadership of this work because of the longstanding work of the Juvenile Court Improvement Program, which has implemented performance measures to assist local courts with CQI activities. We recognize this is a small piece of HB 2345, but I mention it to you today because I want you to know how important the task force believed that gathering and reporting accurate data is to assess performance and improve practice. Now, I realize that the legislature faces significant budget challenges this session. That's an understatement. I also realize that some may argue to you that legal representation for all parties is either unnecessary or that other priorities should be paramount. These arguments, though, go against the weight and reason of this report and the exhaustive research behind it, and they are wrong, respectfully submitted. Adequate representation is an investment in child safety and a backstop against costly mistakes that have threatened public trust in our welfare system. Everyone wants to think about system-wide reform in this arena. Frankly, that's the right way to look at things. Adequate representation, though, is a fundamental part of smart reform because it will raise the quality of court results at all levels. And the need for it doesn't change as you address different problems in the system. For example, of course you also should consider improvements to caseworker training and caseload reductions as well. But a fundamental part of caseworker training and work reduction is to avoid the unlawful practice of law and to have mentoring about the legal consequences of different case plans and strategies from qualified experts. In short, caseworker training versus adequate representation is a false choice. The two are bound together, hand in glove. Adequate representation directly contributes to improved outcomes for children and families by avoiding costly decisional mistakes and delay. This isn't the first time that we've examined the representation system in Oregon, but it is the most thorough and the most complete. And it's the first time that solutions that propose cost-effective results have been recommended. And the findings of the task force, we believe, should be viewed as a statewide call to action for all of us to implement these recommendations and, above all, to continue the collaborative three-branch work that it represents to protect the rights of families and improve the outcomes for our most vulnerable children. I know I've talked a long time, but I really felt it was important to cover these things. I thank you for your time. And if you have questions, I'd be glad to answer them and otherwise yield the floor.
Thank you. Are there questions? Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Justice Brewer, first of all, thank you for a thorough and really informative report. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate your work as chair of this task force very much. This is a very thorny issue, and it's a really important one for us to be considering seriously. I have a question that will sound naive, perhaps, because I'm a doctor, not a lawyer. But how do you balance, or how do you think about the fact that you could potentially have, at bare minimum, four attorneys representing four different parties in a courtroom at the same time? If the DHS worker has an attorney, and the child has an attorney, and the mother has an attorney, and the father has an attorney, or whoever the relevant adults in the child's life are, who don't necessarily all have the same interests? And how do you think about... We heard some really interesting data from Ms. Miller several weeks ago about the promotion of reunification through improved representation as part of juvenile dependency hearings. But I don't know where this piece fits into that. And I don't disagree with you, largely. I'm just trying to understand that issue. Because when you get too many doctors involved with the case, oh, boy. I wouldn't want you to be in that position of having too many doctors. So...
Thank you so much. Senator Steiner Hayward, that's an excellent question because there's a natural tendency to think of a courtroom full of lawyers sort of like the OJ case where it can turn into something that nobody wants to see and doesn't necessarily create the right respect for the results that occur. I'm going to respectfully submit to you that properly run, juvenile courts are very different from what you're envisioning. These are cases where the best work, frankly, is done before people get into the courtroom, where information is exchanged in advance, where it's filtered and processed through the right legal lens. Every party, and these parties are established by this body, is entitled by law and as a matter of due process to have their own representative because there would be a conflict of interest if they didn't. So by definition, they're all entitled to the same plateau or level playing field of legal advice. And if that advice occurs both consistently outside the courtroom, what happens in the courtroom works much better. Mm-hmm. This is a collaborative process. Even though, and I think everybody who comes up here is going to say, these lawyers work awfully hard for their clients to come to the right result for the children. They have a sense, if they're experienced and know the lay of the land, how that case may well come out after an evidentiary hearing. Good lawyering frequently avoids a lot of evidentiary hearings because it produces good settlements that predict the outcome of a much more expensive legal process. So a properly run courtroom can look almost seamless with four or five different attorneys. And I would submit to you that you wouldn't always have one attorney representing DHS and one attorney representing the state in every case, even if DHS has a lawyer in every case, because in about a third of the counties, the DAs don't appear, and the caseworkers are without a lawyer. And I would also suspect that these folks will find ways to work together to efficiently manage their resources. That's their job. This isn't the same adversarial system, even though it can be, when push comes to shove, that we expect in our regular courtrooms. Compare it with the opposite. If you don't have legal advice and you have a scared person, a caseworker that the judge is demanding a bunch of information from, and she's not a lawyer, and she's worried she's making the judge mad, and she says, I have to talk to my lawyer or my manager, the court has to postpone the case. We avoid a substantial majority of that by actually spending a little bit more up front. It's an ounce of prevention, quite frankly, Doctor.
Thank you, Justice. Very nicely done, Justice.
I couldn't help the medical analogy.
Very nicely done. I'm impressed.
So,
thank you.
And the scenario he just stated, I actually had that happen in one of my cases. I've shared with a few of you. You can ask me some other time to share the story where without the appropriate representation, everything got pushed out for an extra 3 months, because something had gone awry and the caseworker didn't know what to do. But Co-Chair Winters.
Yes, since the Co-Chair Winters probably has a lot of questions, but I won't ask all of them that I have. I'll save them for later. But since this is a budget committee, did you actually, and I don't see anywhere in this document, look at, because we're talking more than just one element of cost that would be borne by the state? And those element of costs would include not only if we took the recommendations for the casework attorney, but you also have in that the pilot projects that are taking place in the three counties, which also would require for legal representation, and then what would be the cost if we get into some of the illustration that was made by my good senator. The doc. So all in all, what would be, did you look at those price tags as to the cost, and not just the one cost now, not just the block grant or that cost, but actually the cost that would be borne by those projects if we expanded those?
Right. Co-Chair Winters, the answer to that question is yes. I did not do that personally, but I know that Ms. Koreski has some information. She can tell you to what extent it's been shared with Mr. Bender and with the spotting.
And Co-Chair Winters and members of the committee, I'm happy to share this information with you. I'm not sure that we submitted the cost sheet, because I think that the expanded pilot for the parents and children would be up to this body to determine how much do you want to expand that. We have a price tag for if you wanted to take that statewide. You know, we know about from the task force work group, and then from the work from PDSC, we know about how much, and I'm going to kick this question to Nancy Cosine, who's in the room, about they can price out about what, if that is the desire of the committee, about how much do you want to expand that project, what counties, I mean, not all counties are created equal. We all know that Lane's more expensive than Josephine, you know.
But I ask that because it's more than just the request was made by Ms. Cosine, but it's also some of the recommendations inside of the report, which also include probably additional cost to CASA. So I'm looking at overall, if I took in your recommended request that are in this document, mm-hmm. Did you price it?
Yes, ma'am. And The price ranges on the sheet that that Addie Smith left for me include a price tag with a rollout and a price tag without a rollout. And those price tags, there's about a $20 million price difference between those, and they range from about $24 million to $45 million.
For this total document?
For the total full meal deal. I don't have a good, I just have a McDonald's reference, not a medical reference. Sorry.
That's not a one that medical people like very much.
So, but if you want the big fries and the big drink, $45
million. Yeah. On that note, thank you. Let's invite up Nancy Cozine and Caleb Yant. I'm going to just call people up two at a time because that's what realistically fits at the desks here. So thank you for your presentations, and please do any additional information you think we might not have, especially on the numbers, please submit those.
So
she's trying to put a thumb drive in.
And I gave Justice Brewer quite a bit of, not extra time, but quite a bit of time there, given that he chaired the task force to lay out kind of the whole scenario for us all. I wouldn't expect that each person's presentation from here forward would be even close to that long.
Should I start?
Have at it.
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the subcommittee, my name is Nancy Cozine. I'm the Executive Director at the Office of Public Defense Services. I want to thank you for having us included in today's presentation. We were asked to address 8 questions. I'm going to try to fly through those in the interest of time. So please feel free to slow me down if need be. The first question we were asked to answer was to explain the agency's role in dependency cases and how services are currently delivered. So the agency is statutorily obligated to provide representation in all cases where there is a statutory or constitutional right to counsel. That includes dependency cases that consume about 31% of the caseload. And as Senator Steiner Hayward pointed out, for every one petition filed, our agency can be responsible for providing many lawyers, mother, father, child. If there's a conflict of interest, we can actually have multiple lawyers for several children. It consumes approximately 28% of the public defense budget. And currently, we provide representation in most counties on a flat rate basis. What that means is that a $1 figure is provided for all representation services at different stages of the case. So as an example, we have average case rates here on this slide. The $792 is a total amount for representation for those first 60 days. That includes the shelter hearing, reviewing all discovery, meeting with clients, doing the investigation, doing all case preparation, legal research, writing, motions, trial, and that's the flat rate. And so the historical problem we have is that as the out-of-court work has continued to be more and more demanding, lawyers do not have time to do the essential work. As you heard from Justice Brewer, some of the most important decisions are actually made outside the courtroom. When lawyers have too many cases and their time is spent exclusively in the courtroom, they're not able to provide representation to their clients at those very critical stages where placement decisions and treatment decisions are being made. So as you'll hear in our parent-child representation program, we've been able to change that dynamic. The total costs for the 17-19 biennium without, as currently projected, are just above $58.7 million.
Nancy, back a slide. On the 2581 termination of parental rights proceedings, is that for just the termination, that one hearing, or is that?
That's for every bit of work that goes into, once the termination of parental rights petition is filed, that's a flat rate, and no matter how much time the case takes, that's the rate. Termination of parental rights trials are very complex. They're typically scheduled for multiple days, up to a week, and sometimes consume several weeks.
Is it the same rate if it's termination without the parent present?
It is the same rate if it is termination without the parent present. Okay. Typically, a lot of preparation goes into that, mm-hmm. even when the parent doesn't ultimately arrive.
Right. Thank you.
The second question was to talk a little bit about historical. The second question was current service level. The third question was historical caseload. This shows caseload back to 2012. And then I included another slide. It's hard to see on this because in the last 2 years, we've actually been seeing an uptick. Typically, when caseload rises and falls, actually, we lose practitioners. So the cases per attorney doesn't change. It's really just we have fewer attorneys handling these cases when there are fewer cases in the statewide system. We were asked to address task force recommendations and how they would change the way services are delivered. So as mentioned by Justice Brewer, we examined six different models using 10 indicators of quality representation. After an extensive review, the task force recommended a shift to a workload model similar to our parent-child representation program. In this program, we do have caseload caps, and I was asked to describe how that changed practice in our three pilot counties, and so I brought some examples. In Linn County, practitioners were carrying approximately 94 dependency cases, and they were also doing privately retained work in order to sustain their businesses. In Yamhill County, attorneys were typically handling approximately 100 dependency cases, plus other public and private work. And in Columbia County, practitioners had approximately 109 open dependency cases, plus additional public and private work. So in those counties now, they are handling no more than 80 weighted cases. They also have access to social workers in 10 to 12% of the cases. We have extensive quality assurance reviews on those cases. And we provide funding that allows practitioners to reduce the amount of public and private work outside of the dependency cases so that they can actually sustain their practice doing this work without having to build up excessive caseloads. Studies have shown that improved representation of parents and children yield system efficiencies and improve outcomes because of the critical role that parents are playing. I'm skimming over these because you have the slides available. I'm happy to answer more questions. And you've also heard a little bit about this program already. I do want to point out that in addition to the efficiencies and improved outcomes, there are savings. In Washington State, they have found about $7.5 million in savings after the expenses of the program are already paid. In New York State, $9 million in savings. In our own parent-child representation program, we've seen improved outcomes, including reduced use of foster care, preservation of families, expedited permanency, and overall improved representation with a 95% client satisfaction rate, which is truly remarkable in dependency cases. Right now, Amy Miller, the program manager for the Parent-Child Representation Program, is actually at the American Bar Association annual conference presenting information on Oregon's efforts to improve representation for parents and kids. And we are also being considered for a national study on improvements in child welfare. So we'll keep you posted on whether or not we are selected. But we, along with many other states, are looking at this issue and looking at ways that we can improve the lives of families and kids involved in the child welfare system. We were asked to talk about the cost of a statewide implementation, any policy option packages associated with the task force recommendations, and potential rollout. So a full rollout in this biennium would be just over $36 million. We have two policy option packages addressing the task force recommendations. One is Policy Option Package 100, and the other one is Policy Option Package 104. Policy Option Package 100 is the package that would actually allow us to expand into other Oregon counties outside of our current pilot programs. So we had three phases, each one covering approximately one-third of the state caseload. Package 100 includes phase one, which is approximately $10.8 million. That would cover all costs of the program. Policy option package 104 is the component that would let us have a research analyst to evaluate representation and outcomes in our PCRP counties and our non-PCRP counties. In terms of a rollout, we have these three stages identified. Of course, these were costed out for the 17-19 biennium. Any rollout that is not done in this biennium would have to be reassessed in terms of cost in the following biennium. And that is a factor of both caseload and obviously the costs of doing business. This shows some of the ideas that we had around what counties would be included in a phase one rollout. There is room for evaluation consideration. We could include one large county, two medium counties, and one small county, depending on which counties are selected. So it is scalable, and we have the annual costs broken down per county and can provide that information to you. In terms of a timeline, we would like to be able to launch in January of 2018. This slide demonstrates roll-up costs. So for each phase, you can see what the costs would be in the next biennium if we were to roll out this biennium. And you can see that a 17-19 rollout would be just over $36 million with a roll-up cost of just under $48 million. The seventh thing we were asked to address was performance measures, measuring results of the program, and quality control. So we have a key performance measure targeting the work done in our parent-child representation program counties, and we look at the time spent with clients. This slide demonstrates that approximately 54% of attorneys report spending about a third of their time with clients, which we expect all attorneys to spend a third of their time with clients. What we have found, though, is that when you look at the entire defense team, the percent that meet the mark are much, much higher. It's closer to 50% when you include all those different entities. And we continue to measure that. We were also asked to talk a little bit about what other states and what the task force looked at in other states in terms of caseload caps. And I did want to mention that the range seemed to be between 60 and 80. Washington State had initially a caseload cap of 90, and they found it was way too high, and that's when they reduced it to 80. So I think a caseload cap of 80, you know, we're still finding that lawyers, they have much more time to do excellent work. It's going over 80 would be very difficult, I think. We also have a key performance measure that looks at the continuing legal education courses that the attorneys are getting in their area of practice. Other quality assurance efforts, attorneys submit to us monthly time and activity reports so that we are looking at the not only the time spent with clients, but the use of case managers, investigation, experts, outside of court meetings, caseloads, and use of continuances. We also then do an annual report where we look at the program using data indicators that are the recommended, validated indicators recommended by the American Bar Association. In terms of the last question, are there options to reduce the policy option package? Because this is a county-by-county rollout, it is entirely scalable, and we are happy to work with the legislature and stakeholders to identify critical counties for rollout, as well as, if the legislature were able, a rapid and efficient statewide rollout. And I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
And Senator Steiner Hayward, and then unless there are burning questions, let's submit them or ask them and have them submitted in writing, because I'm looking at half an hour left and a lot of people left.
Yeah, I'll make this really quick, and you don't even have to answer online, Ms. Cozine.
Okay.
I look at the slide that talks about savings, and that's great. I'm assuming those are net savings?
Correct.
Of the cost that you invest? Okay. Same. I'd be really interested. Maybe I can look at these references to understand a little bit more how those things were done. The other question is whether there's documentation that it increases the likelihood that the child will stay home, right, and that reunification will work. And so cost savings are great. Cost savings that result in human savings are even better.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if these studies detail that, but if not, if there's any evidence you have on that, I'd appreciate seeing it.
Senator Steiner Hayward, co-chairs, I'd be happy to provide that information. And we do have a reduced incident of reentry, so I'll get that to you.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Nancy. And I received a pleasant note reminding me that Caleb and CASA were supposed to be up here together. So, Nancy, why don't we have you move, and we'll have the three of you squeezed together. We have Caleb Leanne already up here, Shani Starr, and Kara Reich. Carrie. So you guys can squeeze in and go in whatever order makes sense for you. And we do still have five more people to go after you guys. So
we promise to keep it brief. Thank you, Chair Winters and Chair Stark. My name is Carrie Reek. I'm the Oregon CASA Network Executive Director. And to my left is
I'm Shaney Starr, Executive Director of the CASA program in Marion County.
And I'm Taylor Bian. I'm the Chief Financial Officer of Oregon Housing and Community Services.
Thank you.
So, Caleb, do you want to?
Sure. I will be very brief. I'm here just simply to, I provided a quick memo that is available in OLIS, which just outlines the elements that are within the budget of CASA that runs through our agency, Oregon Housing and Community Services. So it just really quickly describes what's in the 15-17 budget, and then what is in the 2017-19 in the current service level for CASA's budget. And it also notes that the $850,000 investment that came as a result of some of the work of this task force is obviously not part of that current service level, and the cost of program folks will discuss that.
Thank you.
Thank you again, and we'll be brief. Oregon CASA Network is a membership organization that consists of 22 local programs that serve 35 counties. We're local programs. Most about 90% of the programs are independent 501c3s, and we report to a lot of different entities to ensure that we're in compliance with any standards and statutes.
So our priorities for this biennium are that we're able, as a program and as required by statute, that we meet the needs of all children in care. And that means making sure that every child in care is appointed a CASA. We are grateful that the task force included CASA in their recommendations and took into account the needs of our program. And we do support the recommendations in that task force. However, we would respectfully ask until we as a program, programs across the state, are able to serve all of the children in foster care, that the funding that's laid out in the task force report be directed to our local programs. And that would allow us to increase our capacity to meet the needs of the 56% of children in the state that do not have a CASA. Current service and delivery, we are the legal we are considered a legal party to the dependency cases. We recruit, train, and supervise community volunteers who are extensively trained to advocate for all the children in care.
So I'm going to skip the next section that gives more specific information about facilitating, monitoring, advocating, and facilitating. Those are in the slides presentation that you were given. We have additional expectations that we report to the judge. We work with all legal parties, including all of the attorneys on the case.
So in fiscal year 2015 and 16, with our funding capacity, we were only able to serve 44% of the children who were in legal custody of the state. And that was approximately 5,000, leaving just over 6,500 to not have a CASA advocate. We do report to the court through written reports and testimony if that's requested of us at any hearing. We use the information that we gather through our process and investigation process to facilitate positive outcomes for the children. So, I'll go ahead and just skip through the recommendation that was laid out in the report that you all received. And just to kind of, I know we're talking about dollars here, the anticipated biennium costs for the portion of the task force report that was specific to CASA would be $854,000.
The role of the attorneys within CASA would include, when needed, representation in court for difficult cases where witnesses needed CASA felt that witnesses should be subpoenaed. They would assist with that process, as well as any type of preparation for the more complicated cases. It would also allow programs across the state to contact an attorney to interpret law for us, or to interpret a court, some specific legal documents. Again, advocates are community trained member or community members who are specifically trained. We're not trained in the legal aspect, and so this gives us the additional opportunity to have that resource. Currently, we have models where independent local programs have attorneys that are working for that are resources at pro bono. We also have some directors who are attorneys as well, and so we very much share the legal needs of us between all the different programs throughout the state.
I'll just finish up our presentation by just reiterating that our goal statewide for all of our local programs is to ensure that every child who is in care of this state has a safe home and has the opportunity to thrive, and that every child should have a CASA. Thank
you. So just to summarize and make sure I understood you correctly, you like the task force recommendation, you would very much use the $854,000, but given the choice, you would rather put that funding into a higher priority of which you guys have just outlined.
Absolutely.
Yes. So currently, the state funding for CASA is 17% of our budget, and we fundraise the rest. So increasing the capacity of programs to train, to hire staff, to be able to supervise the advocates that we need to serve more children is our highest priority.
Any questions for this panel?
Well, no, but I think I already knew what their answer was going to be, because Marion County, thanks to Shaney and Dick McNeil, are busy in this community trying to increase the number of CASAs, you know, and the statistic that Shaney referenced in the comparison of what the need for a CASA is really great across the state, that we do not have a CASA volunteer for every child, which is a part of the goal. In fact, I don't think we're at even at 50%, are we, Shaney?
Not in Marion County, no.
And you guys already know how I feel about CASA. Fantastic. All right, other questions? All right, thank you very much.
Thank
Appreciate
you,
your
thank
time.
You.
And next up, we have Fred Boss and Joanne Southey. They set a fantastic example of being quick and to the point.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss, and I'm the Attorney General. Because of the importance of dependency representation to the Attorney General and our client DHS, I personally sat on and participated in the Juvenile Dependency Task Force. It became evident over the last few years that our billable hour model may not fit this type of work that our child advocacy section, the section that represents DHS's child welfare division, would work for them. This section is unique in DOJ. Our attorneys are in the courtroom every day and prepare and litigate hundreds of hearings per month. The work of the DHS Child Welfare requires regular and consistent client contact on critically important decisions related to child and safety and families. It has also become clear to us that DHS caseworkers need regular consultation and representation from DOJ attorneys throughout the life of a case. DOJ caseworkers need their own attorney representing them in the courtroom in all hearings so that judges can make decisions based on all relevant facts and applicable laws. When this does not occur, unnecessary mistakes can be made at a great cost and strain to the system. Recognizing that our current model of government representation, including the billable hour model, was not working, the Task Force Subcommittee on Alternate Models crafted models of representation based on best practices from other states and best practices here in Oregon. After ranking each model, a DOJ model with a flat fee funding structure rose to the top. And that's what was ratified by the Task Force. We agree that this model is the best one and would allow us to work proactively with DHS on cases from start to finish. We also agree that having performance standards in place for our attorneys is important. Because we bill our client for our services, the financial aspect of our package with current service level will be handled in the DHS presentation and the DHS slides. But I'd like to turn the presentation over to Joanne Southey, who is the Deputy Chief Counsel and in charge of this activity.
Thank you. Co-Chair Senator Winters and Representative Stark, we just want to very briefly thank Representative Stark, Senators Cruz, Brzezinski, and now Senator Taylor for their participation in that task force and all those hours we put into looking through different models and determining what was best for children and families in Oregon. As you heard, and it's always good to follow Justice Brewer because you don't need to then go back, and I was making slashes through my notes as well, not to reiterate everything, but the juvenile dependency law is complex, and cases need to be managed both inside and outside of the courtroom. It's not just grabbing a file and running into court. When DHS has to appear without an attorney, they can only report to the court, and they're not able then to advocate for their position. They're not able to present evidence or even question a witness that another party has called. And they do get grilled. They get grilled by other attorneys. They get grilled by the court, and that is the role. And unfortunately, that's the position that they're put in, which gets them scared to go to court, which gets them frustrated, which gets them muddled, and they're not going to understand what happened when they're in court. It's not uncommon for AAGs to review court orders, you know, a month or two after a court hearing and discover the agency was ordered to do something. We have also appeared in court representing DHS, defending them in contempt actions against a court when they've failed to comply with such an order. Most importantly, perhaps, is that lack of consistent legal representation can affect child safety. It can occur where if the child's of a certain age, that they have an attorney representing their interests and their position, which may be to go home to an unsafe parent. You have a parent attorney arguing that that child should be returned to their care and potentially no attorney in the courtroom to say why that's a bad idea or to present evidence to show what's in the best interest of that child, according to the DHS, their legal guardian. The lack of legal representation results in cost to the state for continuing the child in subsidized care, for the additional court time and parents' attorney time, as we've always heard. Currently, CHAZ attorneys are available to provide legal service and legal advice to DHS throughout the life of a child welfare case. But depending on the county, DOJ attorneys either appear post-jurisdictionally on contested hearings and trials, or because of the mishmash of our hybrid system and some of the changes that have occurred over the last couple of years, we've appeared much more frequently in certain counties due to either the court demanding it, some pilot programs that we have running, or where DA has unfortunately had to withdraw from a court appearance for various reasons. Many cases involve complex issues that need to be addressed outside of the courtroom, like paternity, discovery, immigration, placement. All of these kinds of things go on that are not necessarily triggered by a hearing that happens 3 months later. Attorney caseloads at DOJ really depend on the level of court involvement and the location. The current system that we have, therefore, it's really hard to predict a set number. The goal of the model, which you'll see in a minute, that was recommended by the task force was to kind of standardize that and include some kind of weighted system. The current system that we have is unpredictable and very inefficient. We're one of only two states with a model like this, and you've heard about the problems that that creates. Also, this problem isn't going away. The temporary law that provides that DHS caseworkers can appear without an attorney does sunset in June of 2018. The governor's task force, as you heard, was charged with recommending the models. Multiple different agency representation models were discussed and evaluated, and all of those attributes that Justice Brewer discussed. As a result of that in-depth discussion, it was determined that the consistent and continuous legal representation of DHS child welfare by DOJ throughout every juvenile dependency court proceeding was the recommended model. This was determined to best improve the overall efficiency and cost effectiveness of the child welfare system, improve caseworker job satisfaction, aid with retention, avoid the unlawful practice of law, and promote that attorney-caseworker collaboration. Again, you've heard it's a block grant model that will allow us to manage doing a workload method of cases. This model also would allow an attorney to handle cases from petition to permanency, so you don't lose that knowledge transfer when one attorney comes in or out or there's no attorney present at all. Under this model, the AAGer will appear with DHS at every dependency court hearing, will consult with DHS pre-filing of dependency petitions, and will be regularly on site at local DHS branches for case consultation and advice. Also, this model will allow DHS to leverage federal grant and reimbursement programs against legal costs. The implementation to comply with task force directives.
Just a moment. Representative Pelosi.
Thank you, Chair Stark. Just a real quick question, and I apologize for interrupting, but this is a new proposal. Can you just give me a real brief understanding of what the current process is? All right. Thank you very much. That'll work.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So the identification of an implementation plan is still in the works and is required to be reported back to the legislature by September of this year. But in order to kind of get going on that, DHS and DOJ kind of came up with a plan of a rolled-in phase tiered implementation. We ran that by the ODAA to see if there was a preference in county rollout and which order and timelines and what would work best for everybody. Each phase we've tried to do includes counties that total approximately one-third of the child welfare cases statewide, so that rollout is then staggered to occur every 6 months beginning in January 2018. So the anticipated phases and who is included and the timeline is included on this slide. In addition to the current service level for legal assistance, DOJ currently represents DHS at jurisdiction in that early stage of cases in almost about just over 20% of the cases already statewide. So that first phase of implementation includes all of those counties and then perhaps another one or two where the DAs indicated they're unable to appear as of the next biennium. Phases two and three include the counties where DA has agreed or has stated that they're able to continue that status quo for appearances, and then that would allow for a much more meaningful transition. We considered and attempted to look at the needs of the counties, regional staffings, and fiscal impact. And in order to staff up, we would then, of course, engage in recruitment efforts to include attorneys from across the state to handle this specialized work. And DOJ and DHS continue to work together on the cost per biennium, depending on how the legislature intends that this implementation be rolled out. If it's approved to be a staggered rollout, if it's approved to be in phases, which counties would be included in which phase, because as we heard earlier, Lane County is a lot different than Curry County.
And I'll point out, if anyone's new to this information, we just talked about, between the last couple of presentations, two different rollouts. One of the reasons that those would look different time-wise is because there are two different parts of the recommendation, and each of those parts are unique in the different counties. So it does make sense that they don't necessarily overlap perfectly.
Thank you, Co-Chair. We were also,
and we do have to wrap up quickly because we have three more people and 10 more minutes.
Yep. we were asked to hit on performance standards, quality control measures. That's in our written materials. We're well underway with that process. We actually have a finalized document that we're just waiting to see how this legislation plays out as to how to fine tune it. And we thank you for your time.
thank you
very much. All right. Next up, we have Walt Beglow and Rod Underhill.
I don't think it's Rod.
I'm standing in for Rod.
That doesn't look like Rod.
Gosh. Rod, you look different today. All right, Mr. Neely.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee. My name's Walt Beglow. I'm the Marion County District Attorney, and I'll just jump right in. I want to express my appreciation to Justice Brewer and the members of the committee. They did great work, and I know they're all committed to Oregon's families. I got just 4 points to touch base on here: the DA's role in juvenile dependency, the task force recommendations relative to district attorneys' performance, and then alternatives to the implementation, and I'll cover those pieces. So basically, local district attorneys do this work at a financial deficit because they believe that this work is critical to child safety. We take local ownership over these families because we believe these are the families in our communities need our support. Currently, the Department of Human Services have heard contracts separately with each county to determine the scope of their work. This has created inconsistency statewide. And so the Oregon District Attorneys Association recognizes this is a problem. And we're committed to increasing the standardization or creating some common denominators across Oregon to make sure this work is done right. And so we also feel that flexibility, because we need to tailor services to communities because they have their own culture, they own their own footprint, and that's really important as well. In terms of the cost, Marion County, for example, and there are other counties that have a similar price point, we can do the full representation model at about $58 an hour. recommendations. I'm very respectful of the scope of the task force, but the task force was not asked to put or consider child safety as paramount. And so the task force identified areas where ODA is committed to do better, that standardization I mentioned, the increased training for Department of Human Services workers, and appropriately preparing those workers for court. We've heard that repeatedly today. This is essential to reshaping child safety in Oregon. The task force noted that DAs do not represent the agency. They do not. We do not think this is best practice. How shall I say this? This is not the best way to represent the best interests of the child, and that multiple eyes in a courtroom with different viewpoints create the best model of protecting kids forward. And this one is a real big deal for me because this is where I spent most of my career. The task force did not consider the legally required child abuse multidisciplinary model. This is the benchmark of how you protect kids and family. And DAs, as you know, are statutorily required to oversee these local MDTs. It creates efficiency. It promotes child safety. And the bottom line, this is where powerful relationships are created that save lives of children. I've actually personally see it work. So in Marion County, we have embedded law enforcement, DHS, and the district attorneys at our Liberty House, our Child Abuse Assessment Center. They're literally on site, are going to be co-locating. And that MDT, your DA, is just going to be at that. They're going to be making those calls. And that's going to be a struggle, I think, for the Department of Justice to make that commitment at that level. Performance, child safety, in terms of lawyers appearing in court, I'm not sure that's the best metric. We think it should be measured in terms of reduction of Department of Human Services work turnover. We see that increase the worker satisfaction and reducing time into permanency there. And so we just think those investments should be made in caseworkers, in training, lower caseloads. Let's work with the people doing the work. And that's where I think your investments should be. Finally, alternatives. Just put the money where the greatest need is. We've talked with other DAs, and they share the similar experiences. The training and the caseworkers would benefit from that effort, and the DAs are committed to that. We also recommend a dependency liaison, a two-year, one FTE person that could create this bridge between service delivery at Department of Human Services and the district attorneys and the work that's being done. And that I think that would lift our effort quite significantly. So, again, thanks for inviting our testimony. I know it looks different than what you've heard from the work group, but many of us have been doing this a very, very long time, and we think a local investment matters, and we're here to give you our commitment to that for Oregon's families. So thank you.
Thank you.
And we have Chair Kevin Neely, Oregon District Attorneys Association, and I will try to keep it to 30 seconds. I'm not even going to go through the slide presentation. You guys have it available. There's pretty three-legged stools there, stuff like that. I'm not going to talk about that. I wanted to just give you a picture of the work we're doing and the price point we're doing it at. As District Attorney Beglau just said, most counties are engaged in this work. 32 out of Oregon's 36 counties are doing it. About 20 of those counties are getting funding from DHS, as you've heard. This slide shows you what we're doing for about $2 million at a very responsible price point, because the counties are backfilling a huge portion of the costs, because, as I think you just heard from Walt, this is a fundamental service that they believe will protect children. Our big concern here, and you heard Justice Brewer mention this, one of the ways that the attorneys are paid for DHS is by eliminating the funding in DHS for the DAs to participate in this process. We are a fundamental backstop here. We recognize the importance of this work in our community. We recognize how to keep children safe in our community. And if that funding disappears, a lot of these communities are simply unable to step forward and do the work. So we'd encourage you, and we've been working with DHS to try to find a model that keeps us involved. We'll continue to do that. But we hope that you guys, as you make your funding decisions, understand and recognize the value of having the DA there. With that, I close. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
I have one quick question.
Senator Winters.
And that is that, are you, I know at one point that, and I'm going to direct it to you, Walt, and that is going back to the multidisciplinary team and whether or not that training that used to occur with DHS, is that occurring now or has it been suspended of what's happening with that kind of training?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I understand that training is all but dried up. I think I saw a note that it was been 10 years since we've had that collaborative multidisciplinary training component. And that is incredibly important to preparing caseworkers to go into court and to avoid legal issues where they need representation. So I guess my point is it's not there, and we're committed to going forward with a training, a regimen.
And as a quick aside on that, there is a bill that just passed the House the other day that kind of reinstates some of that training with DOJ and the caseworkers and requires them to have more training on what it is and is not. What it does and does not mean to practice law for them. Senator Frederick.
Just one quick.
And I would invite members of this panel just to follow up to visit Liberty House, because I was there the other night, and I do know about what is being provided in this community to actually have those teams in the community. And if you have a spare time, please go and visit Liberty House.
And before Senator Frederick, just a heads up, we are at our time. However, so if you need to leave, I understand. I want to make sure the agency has at least a minute per slide, but it's preparing them for when we actually have an official hearing on the bill itself, so you'll be well prepared. But Senator Frederick.
Yes, could you go back to that slide that you had up there? I want to get sure that's – there are two counties there that stand out for me that I consider to be just a little bit of a surprise in terms of the numbers. If you wouldn't mind explaining, I mean, I expect to see large numbers in Multnomah County and Marion because of the people there, in Clackamas and Washington, but Jackson County and Yamhill County, Klamath County, surprised me.
Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters, Senator Frederick, in the interest of time, that's a complicated answer, and we will provide the committee with a written response to that if you're comfortable with it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. And Mr. Chair, while they're coming up, I just say,
thank you, gentlemen.
This issue, the issue that we've been considering here today and some of the comments you'll hear from the Department of Human Services is one that we're obviously considering in some depth in the Human Services Subcommittee as well. And unfortunately, these two committees don't meet at the same time, so it's hard to get. But Senator Winters and I obviously are both on that one. We had a long meeting with them, and this issue came up there as well. So we are eager to engage. My co-chair and I are eager to engage with you and co-chair Winters on the subject to figure out about funding and leveraging of funds and things
Excellent.
Like that, because we think that this is really an overlapping issue.
And Mr. Psyche, my apologies for putting you at the end and having you have so little time once we got here.
No apologies necessary, co-chair. Chair Stark, Chair Winters, members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Psyche, Department of Human Services, and in the interest of time, I'll move through this rather quickly. I just wanted to start by saying that this has been an issue, and Representative Krieger, before he left office, reminded me that we have worked on this issue for 12 years now, and I think 12 years is more than enough to work on an issue, and we really need to get the resolution on this issue, because during the 12 years, we've really struggled as an agency with this issue. I would like to thank Justice Brewer. I think part of the reason that we struggled with it for 12 years is because we've never had as a comprehensive and thorough a process in really examining this issue and trying to get to the right recommendations. And so on behalf of our caseworkers and our child welfare staff, I'm hopeful that we will be able to move forward here. So really the recommendation is around block grant or flat fee where DOJ would provide full representation for the agency. And I really wanted to kind of talk a little bit really quickly about what that means, because it is full representation throughout the life of a case. And when I talk about representation, it's in court proceedings. And the next slide, we'll get to Representative Peluso's question about what the current system looks like. But I think the other three are just as important. That ongoing consultation that our workers could access so that they can actually be prepared to go to court. And I think Chair Stark, your the example you raised earlier in the hearing happens way too often, where we have to set something aside because we weren't prepared or didn't have the right things, and that doesn't serve anybody's purpose well. And then the other piece of it is the training component, which I think is so critical. And I'll just give you a real quick example. You know, we're asking our caseworkers to write court reports. Some of our caseworkers want to be very thorough, so they will include everything in the kitchen sink in the court report. And then when the judge gets it, the judge has to sort through a 10-page document to find what the relevant information is. And to be honest with you, the judges aren't happy about that. And so, you know, that kind of creates a dynamic right off the bat. The other thing is that we have some caseworkers who are very concise and brief and don't include all of the pertinent information. And so I just use that as an example of just training that could occur that would really make the process a lot more efficient and effective. And then the last piece is around standardization and consistency. I firmly believe that the representation you get and the process you go through, it should not be incumbent on what part of the state you live in. Everybody is entitled to the same representation and the same opportunity. I don't care if you live in Ontario or if you live in Portland. So to your question, Representative Peluso, this chart shows you kind of what the current system is. And on the very first line, DOJ provides advice to us statewide through their general counsel, not always specifically on certain cases at times, but on policy and questions of law. They, under the current system, typically will step in and represent us if we need to after the jurisdictional trial and disposition hearing. So up until that point in time, they typically are not involved in representing us. However, in Lane, Coos, Polk, Benton, Lake, and Morrow County, we have kind of what's being proposed where they represent us from throughout the life of the case in those specific counties for a variety of reasons. In some cases, the county has decided they don't want to represent us, and so DOJ has taken over that role. In 29 counties, the DAs represent us through the jurisdictional trial and disposition hearing, and then after that, typically the caseworkers through the rest of that process would be unrepresented unless we have an instance where we specifically ask DOJ to come in and represent us. But typically in that scenario, they're unrepresented and they're appearing by themselves in court. The one exception is Multnomah County, where they represent us through jurisdictional trial and disposition hearing. And then we have an intergovernmental agreement where they come in at the very end to do the termination of parental rights, the TPR. But then again, through that, there is that gap where there is no representation for the workers in court. So that, I don't know if you have any questions, Representative, but that's kind of what the representation spectrum looks like currently.
Okay.
So very quickly on the budget side, this is the current budget for dependency, for the biennium, 21.21, other DOJ fees, 3.29, for a total of 24.5. If you're looking at the full representation and the implementation plan we shared with you early, dependency would jump up to an additional $6.9 million of general fund, because we would then leverage an additional $13 million worth of federal fund, Title IV E money. And the total budget with the policy option package would be $45.84 million, $40 million for dependency, and then $5.74 for other costs. Now, I just want to refer back to a comment that Mr. Neely made about price point. I don't think this is an apples-to-apples comparison when you look at kind of what the information they provided and the information you provided, because it really is a difference in the type of service, consultation, training that we would be getting under one model that we typically don't get under the current model. And so I just want to wrap up and tell you that, you know, as I came on into this role, shortly after I started, I did a series of town hall meetings, and every time we went to a town hall meeting, Representative Stark was at the meeting in Medford, and Representative Peluso was the one in Portland. I also scheduled branch visits while I was in the local area. And legal representation consistently was one of the things that came up as we talked about what is it that we need to do to better support you in the field. In addition to that, we commissioned a work group because we really wanted to understand from our folks what are your pain points, and if we were going to make things better for you, what could we do? And the work group consisted of caseworkers, line supervisors, and program managers from child welfare throughout the state. And they came up with about 10 priorities for us to look at, and legal representation was the third bullet on the list. I think that there's no silver bullet for us to improve the child welfare system. There are a number of things we're going to have to do, and we're going to have to do things concurrently. Training is a huge issue. I think legal representation is a big issue. I will tell you, though, if you have a system that has some systemic flaws in it, just throwing bodies at the issue does not solve the problem. Because unless we solve these systemic issues, we are going to continue to suffer with a high turnover rate. And you can give me all the positions you have, and that won't necessarily have the impact that will get us to the place that we all want to get to. So with that, I'll stop. Chair Stark?
Thank you, and thank you for your brevity and patience.
Absolutely.
And waiting through this, any burning questions now that we are over? All right, and this is an ongoing conversation in multiple committees. So if you have more information you want to get to us, please get it to us. On that note, we are adjourned. Thank you for staying late, everybody.
Clyde, thank you. See you back. Clyde, you're well.
Late, everybody.
Clyde, thank you. See you back.